My name is Luigi Luca Cavalli Sforza, a long one, and I was born in Italy, in Genova, in 1922, which is a long time ago. And I didn't stay long in Genova because my father then moved, my family moved to Torino, and I did all my schools in Torino, so I consider myself essentially from that part of Italy in terms of culture. And I have been going to school, the regular curriculum in Italy at the time, it was strictly classical. And for a while I thought, why did they teach me so much Latin, not more mathematics, so that I had to learn mathematics later when I was at university doing medicine. But I realized that it wasn't too bad, because after all, Latin was learned in depth. And that gave me both an exercise in deduction and in induction.
Sure.
So a more complete type of training than the kind of biology study that is done still now in many universities, which is basically a teaching of names and names and names, which is not very interesting.
Sure.
So I did not like going to school so much, so I took early examinations for going to university. My first year was in Turin, but then I discovered, actually my grandparents discovered, that I could go to Pavia, to a good college. Pavia is the only university in Italy that has a college system. A little bit like Oxford or Cambridge, though not as universal. And it was a very good part of my life, because an only son, and therefore I thought I was a little bored at home, although my parents were delightful. And I found a great number of brothers, and I really enjoyed the time that I spent there. So I graduated in medicine, because I didn't know what to do when I came out of high school. And I had seen microscopes, and I thought, well, I'd probably like to look through them. And this is what I did at the beginning. But then I realized I wanted to do a more quantitative type of work that is done in classical biology. And I had good luck of meeting in Pavia a very good geneticist, a young man, Adriano Pizzati Traversi, who had gone to America as a student to learn Drosophila. And Drosophila is a great training in genetics. So that when my eldest son was 14, I brought home a binocular and some Drosophilas and let him play with them, and he enjoyed it enormously. But eventually became a physicist. Not a theoretical physicist, but atomic particle physicist. Mm-hmm. And I decided I wanted to do population genetics. Basically, my professor was doing population genetics. He was also doing radiation genetics, which is not so much fun. But he introduced me, he brought me in 1942. You have to realize that Italy was in war with Germany, together with Germany, against the Allied. And the only place where I could go during the war was Germany. And in Germany, there was an extremely good population geneticist, one of the founders of population genetics, Nikolai Timofeyev-Lesovsky, who was working at what was then the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin, and is now the Max Planck Institute.
Yeah.
So I think the stay in with Timofeyev convinced me I wanted to do genetics. But I had started doing some research in bacteriology, and so I decided I want to go into bacterial genetics, which did not exist at the time. I've always liked to do things where there's not too much competition, because otherwise you just have to run against time and be sure that your colleagues don't steal your ideas don't do them before you. So I became a bacterial geneticist, and after the degree, which was in 1944, still during the war, I managed to get a little job in research in an institute, a pharmaceutical institute, which was a non-profit-making organization, so I was allowed to do some research. And I tried very hard to go to England, where I knew that I would get considerable help in my training. And I managed to get a scholarship only in 1948, because there were difficulties in going abroad after the war for Italians. Anyhow, I managed to get a scholarship, and I worked with Professor Kenneth Mather, very good geneticist I chose, because he was also a very good statistician. Mm. He wrote an excellent book of statistics. And I spent 6 months with him with the scholarship. And I went to my first International Congress of Genetics, which was in Stockholm in 1948. I introduced myself to Professor Fisher, R.A. Fisher, the great Fisher. And very surprisingly, he offered me a job because he had heard that I was working on bacterial genetics, mm-hmm. and he wanted to do crossing over studies in bacteria. He was doing them on mice, and he was tired of the time that one has to wait to get a generation and the limitation of numbers. So he thought in bacteria it would be faster. This was one of the greatest things that happened in my life. So I arrived to Cambridge at the in the fall of 1948, and the tea room was divided into two, and I took half of it and developed a small bacteriological lab. Wow. And so I started working bacteria on a new theme, which Fisher had discovered reading on genetics, a famous paper by Joshua Lederberg, published in 1947, which showed that there is sex in bacteria and that you can cross bacteria and they undergo crossing over. Fisher was probably the first person who believed it and understood exactly what was going on, of course. So I requested Josh Lederberg to send me his strains and started working on crossing over in bacteria. The problem with working on crossing over in bacteria was that the strains that had been developed by Lederberg demanded selecting for recombinants, which are extremely rare, one in a million or less. And therefore, it was always necessary to study a very selected set of recombinants. And I was very lucky, because I started doing some mutations that I was interested in, and one of these turned out to be the first strain that ever showed very frequent recombination. I couldn't really take two bacteria and put them together and see them crossing. Now you can, but at that time it still had to be done in by some kind of selection. But the real problem was that I don't think bacteria have a real meiosis. The strain I had found with very high frequency of recombination, which is called HFR, for many reasons, did not seem to have a kind of regular meiosis like we are used to see in higher organisms, so that there was a continuous segregation of recombinants. But the thing in itself was so interesting that it was inevitable to start working on this new strain and on the sex and bacteria, and rather than on crossing over, because crossing over was difficult to study. But this was a new phenomenon, and it turned out that sex could be transmitted infectiously with some strains, but in others it behaved as a gene on the chromosome. Mm. And eventually we were able to conclude that there was a particle in the cytoplasm which could be transmitted infectiously and pass the capacity to have sex of the low frequency type. Mm. But if the particle went onto the chromosome, then recombination became very frequent. Now, I happened to do this work while Josh Lederberg also was doing that. And so we never met at that time, but we were in continuous correspondence. And when we discovered we were doing the same thing, we decided to publish it together. Meanwhile, I had passed all the information about doing crosses to a friend, Bill Hayes, who was in Cambridge for a short while at the time. And he also found another high recombination strain, which was quite different. And eventually, the French researchers, essentially two, François Jacob and Lee Volman, found ways of producing a large number of them and of using them for very beautiful work that developed further our knowledge. But at that time, bacterial genetics had become so popular that it had become very difficult to do research. One has to rush in order to do it and then publish it soon. And I didn't like that, especially because working in Italy, I was a little bit out of the center of the game. And therefore I decided to change. And because I liked population genetics, I discovered from a student where I was teaching genetics at the University of Parma, a student who was a priest, and he his name is Antonio Moroni, and he knew that there was a lot of material in the Catholic Church that was potentially interesting for genetics. Basically, there were dispensations for consanguineous marriages that gave an idea of the frequency of consanguineous marriages, which of course are of some interest genetically. And also, this was the other thing, there were parish books which gave the demography of 500 years mm-hmm. almost. And I was fascinated by that, and I thought that I was convinced that drift, which Motu Kimura has correctly called more intelligently random genetic drift, to distinguish it from the common use of the word drift. In fact, drift is a misnomer. Mm-hmm. Because drift is a specific trend in a direction. And this is how it is used in physics and in linguistics. But in genetics, it's used as a random phenomenon due to small population size. Now, I thought that drift was much more common. In fact, in this way, I disagreed with Fisher, because Fisher had written major papers. Fisher wrote the first distribution of drift, of the statistical distribution. But he thought that populations were too large for it to be important. However, I was looking at it from another point of view. I was looking at specific sections of a population and the variation within a population. And I decided that having a potentially very good ally, an intelligent priest who was interested in genetics, who was Antonio Moroni, I would be able to do a comparison of demography in populations, in real populations, and genetics. At the time, there were not many genes that one could study. But I was very familiar, because of my work in pharmaceutical firm, with blood groups, and also Fischer-Lapp blood groups. So this is one of the things that we'd love to talk together about. And I could do blood groups, but also I could do the demography. And so I thought, well, the demography of a population should tell me how much to live to expect, because it tells me everything about the two quantities you need for understanding drift. You need to know population size. Mm-hmm. You also need to know migration in a peculiar sense. That is how people find each other for marriage, and because marriage often introduces the genes from the outside of a population, of a village. And that, of course, limits the amount of drift that you will find. In fact, between drift, which differentiates, creates differences among populations, and migration that tends to homogenize them, an equilibrium must fall. Mm-hmm. So I decided to look at the valley where there was, the valley, which is the same name as the university where I was, the Valley of Palma, which has largish towns in the plains. And as you go towards the mountains, villages get smaller and smaller, down to 100 times less than in the plains. And I had all the demography of 400 years at least. And so that was hard work. It took a lot of time. And it also took a lot of time to go and collect samples in the villages. Again, having my ally, priest, I could go there on some days, and he would write to all the priests had been his students, and so he knew them very well. And he said, "Now you tell, please tell them that next Sunday there will come a person who will take a blood sample from them." And so we did, and we took blood samples in the sacristy of the church, because there was no other place, and most villages were very, very small. We collected blood samples from 75 villages, some of which were in the mountains, very small, some of which in the hills, an intermediate place, and some of which in the plains. And then when we looked at the differences, the genetic differences among villages, we found that there were differences in the mountains, which were highest, in the hills they were intermediate. In the plains, we couldn't detect the difference. Mm-hmm. So that was the first thing. As a matter of fact, I continued to work on those data later. And we also did a population simulation in order to predict exactly the amount of drift that there should be, because we knew the demography in all the details that were necessary for seeing when, what age people would marry, with whom, from which parish, etc. And we did it only for the part of the valley where we did find a lot of drift, because for the others, we in the plains, with the numbers we were examining, we could not find evidence of drift. And it was quite surprising that in fact, it's only recently that I've concluded this work, and I've concluded that you find exactly the kind of the amount of drift that you expect on the basis of demography. Now, surprising, you might say, well, is it true that natural selection does not exist? Of course, that's not true. But with the numbers we examined, we will not be able to find natural selection for blood groups, because there is some natural selection for blood groups, but it is very modest. And these polymorphisms have resisted for many tens of thousands of years. ABO blood groups don't differ very much among populations, except for DRIFT, for instance, in America, where you don't find, in South America, you find no A or B, probably because they entered only a few individuals at the beginning, and they were probably all blood group O, which is the most common. So, this was my first research. It took a fair amount of time, 5-6 years to finish, and I've continued working on those data later. In fact, more recently I worked on the same with a new type of marker, which is very good because it's extremely cheap to collect, which is surnames. Of course, they are inherited like the Y chromosome. They are not a terribly good marker for the Y chromosome, except that they have a tremendous number of alleles. And so we have done recently research in Italy on surnames. Italy has 58 million people, 340,000 surnames. So, and we can have all the Italian families from the telephone book for nothing. So, when I repeated the research with the surnames on the Parma Valley, I had many more data. And again, it corresponds fairly well with what I expect, with what I expected. But I became more ambitious then because I thought, well, if I study natural selection alone, then I will discover what the genes are good for and or bad for. If I look at the variation of a gene around the world, I will discover the history of that gene. But I want to know the history of people. If I take an average of all genes, of many genes, then maybe I'll be able to reconstruct the history of people. That was done in collaboration with a very good friend whom I invited from Cambridge. He was a PhD student of Fisher. His name is Anthony Edwards, and he is now a professor at Cambridge. And he spent 3 years in Pavia with me. I had moved to Pavia at the time. And we had a computer, the first computer ever bought by an Italian university, which was occupied an entire room, but of course was much less powerful than a personal computer these days. So I wanted to have a number of populations. I asked Anthony to go and see a friend, Morant, in London, who was the master of blood group distribution in the world. He wrote many books that collected the data, but at the time they were not published. I asked him to go and see him and ask him to suggest which populations. I wanted 3 populations per continent. Very far one from the other, so migration would not interfere too much with drift. And I wanted as many genes as possible. Morant managed to find about 20 alleles from 5 blood groups, ABO, RH, MNS, Duffy, and Diego. Those were the genes that had the data for a number of enough populations for us. And then we developed methods to reconstruct evolutionary trees based on a very simple idea that the greater the distance, the longer the separation, so that you can reconstruct separations that happen. And the tree we produced showed that populations from the same continent went together. This was fine. And continents that were near each other went together. And then I thought, well, let's see what we see with anthropometric characters. Because with anthropometric characters, there were anthropometric characters of many populations. So that was a second tree we made. And it was perplexing because we didn't know what to expect out of the first tree. It seemed to give reasonable results, but it wasn't true. So we would like to see it again. And, when we made a tree with anthropometric characters that included skin color and all the sort of measurements that anthropologists collect, we found that the tree was different. It was different because in the tree with genes, Africans had on one side, Australian Aborigines who were very far, and American Indians were on the opposite side. But that was not true of the tree with anthropometric characters, where Africans and Australian Aborigines and New Guineans went together. And, we thought there should have been a very good reason, because there we had a lot of natural selection, much more than you find with blood groups. And so, it's clear that the populations that are at the tropics go together, which was what the anthropometric tree told us. We also developed another of the methods that is done today on a large scale, which are of principal components analysis, multidimensional analysis. And it gave similar results. So this paper was published in 1963, and unfortunately that paper is never cited because I did not follow a good advice I received from Fisher. Fisher told me some time ago, never publish on proceedings of conferences because they get lost. I was lazy, so we published it on proceedings. And then I waited to publish a longer paper. And I waited for another 5 years, which was too long. And of course, to my surprise, this original paper, which I think was rather good, is never cited. I would like to say what happened next. What happened next was that I thought, well, I've put together demography and genetics, and it worked very well with the drift. I want to try to put together archaeology, because that also has information of importance, especially for long-term evolution. I found a collaborator, Albert Ammerman, who was working in Italy at the time, and England. In fact, he graduated, took his PhD at the Royal Institute of Archaeology in London. But he went back to America for work after working with me. And at that time, I went to Stanford and took him with me to Stanford for 5 or 6 years. And we decided to work on what happened, the impact that agriculture had. The idea being that agriculture changed the world demographically by letting people grow. In fact, we know that in the very first period of our species that developed between 100,000 and 150,000 years ago, in East Africa, and probably was from a very small population, a tribe. And then there may have been a few thousand individuals at most, but at the time that agriculture developed, there were already 1,000 times more. They say between 1 and 15 million people lived 10,000 years ago on Earth, and they had occupied essentially all the Earth. And in some places, there were too many people, so someone, in fact more than one person, decided that one couldn't go on living in an economy of hunting and collecting, because foraging is good, but it's nice, but there's not enough food for all of us. And so they started producing food, and that was agriculture and animal breeding. And that, as probably all know, developed in several places. The earliest one was the Middle East, but not much later. It developed in North China, in South China, probably in the Sahara, maybe independently, and in America, in Mexico, and from there it spread all over, but slowly. So we started looking at how fast it spread. The archaeological data were excellent because there were radiocarbon dating of all the of wheat, which was domesticated in the Middle East, but was not in existence in Europe, except for very few places in Greece. And the wheat can be carbon dated, radiocarbon dated. And we made a map of the spread of wheat, and we suggested that maybe farmers had grown, multiplied, and as soon as you multiply too much, you have to migrate, and migrated, and they may have a spread to Europe, or other parts of the world, of course. But, and then the thing to be done was to do the genetics, and there were data, enough data on Europe. It took some time. This was work that I did with two other collaborators that joined me at Stanford. One of them is Alberto Piazza, who is still working and has a beautiful Institute of Genetics that is building up in Torino. And another is, became an ecologist, Paolo Birozzi in Parma. And we collected all the data on the genetics of Europeans that were available. We managed to collect 35 alleles from 20 or so genes. And we decided to use principal components for testing the spread, using principal components in a new way, taking one principal, the first principal component of many European populations, and plotting it on the map, and then taking the second principal component, which recovers all the information that is lost from the first. The first collects as much information as you can. In fact, we estimated that it was about 28% of the information available in our 35 genes. The genes were so highly correlated that the principal components could bring all the information together in one single value. And this single value expressed 28%, well, about one quarter of all the information existing. And that information mimicked exactly the spread from Europe, from the Middle East, of wheat. So we thought, well, there must be something in the idea. Of course, we're very careful, and we said, but it doesn't have to be necessarily diffusion of people, the farmers. It might have been diffusion of the farming as a technology. Sure. And we didn't know what the fraction was. And maybe that quarter was the expression of that, but we didn't say it. And we have been accused by some critics. I think many scientists like to criticize, and this is very good, because science can progress only from discussion and skepticism. And they thought, well, there was nothing. In fact, there was a young man who did an analysis of mitochondrial DNA and claimed that the diffusion of farmers could have been no more than 4%. Actually, he had such bad data, and I knew more about mitochondrial DNA than he knew, that I wrote, your data are not good enough, you have to do it in another way. When he did it another way, he found 20%, which after all is not very different from 28%. Now, is 28% the real estimate of what is the proportion of the diffusion? We call dimic the diffusion of people. The proportion of dimic, and therefore 72% is cultural. Well, there was later some work that was done by others using Y chromosome data, which had come meanwhile, and they found that the proportion was 50 or 60% instead. So it may be that proportion maybe is the average of the. The real proportion is the average of Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA. So mitochondrial DNA is 20%, then White Rama Sama say 50%, then our 28% is not very far. Maybe one third is the reasonable estimate. And people still keep making mistakes about this. Even recently, there were some German scientists who looked at some Neolithic bones, very few, and made a real, a really wrong statement on their basis, because they found some, they thought, oh, it cannot have been a Neolithic diffusion, because we find genes there that don't exist anymore today. But they don't know that many, they seem to ignore the fact that many genes go extinct.
Sure.
So they came across, so they cannot say anything about from them, you know. So this is what the situation today is, that there is still some controversy, but I believe that probably our guess that it was a third. My next...
May I ask you something, Luca? Yeah. Well, dopo lo montiamo. I would like to know more about your relationship with Fisher.
Yes.
So, and your experience in Cambridge in general, because we only have 20 minutes more, something like that.
Really?
Yeah, it's 12:30 and...
Oh, 20 minutes, but it's too long.
We're going to cut and to see how...
I wanted to say something about the linguistics.
Yes, yeah, okay.
Say
linguistics, Fisher and Cambridge, and your present ideas and about I would like you to talk about the cultural genetics.
The linguistics. Now, my next excursion into another field was that of linguistics. And linguistics is clearly an evolution of great importance, and families of languages have been established. I happened to meet at Cambridge, where he was professor, in fact, became very good friends, Professor Joseph Greenberg, who is undoubtedly the best student of linguistic evolution. He contributed to simplifying greatly classification, although he met enormous difficulties with his colleagues. Mostly, I believe, because the majority of linguists are interested in one or few languages, and very few have an interest in examining the general picture. But today, the situation is changing, and there are more linguists who are interested in what is called long-range linguistics. My work on linguistics arose almost by chance, in the sense that I decided, after doing the work on agriculture in Europe, to extend the analysis to the whole world in the same ways, with principal components and trees and things like that. And I was helped very greatly by Menotti and Piazza, and so this is why we wrote together a big book, which some of those who work in the field know, which is called History and Geography of Human Genes. Mm-hmm. It was published in 1994. It treated about 1,800 populations and about 120 genes that were sufficiently widely known. Almost all proteins, a little bit of mitochondria. The work on linguistics arose in part from my interest in talks with linguists, but also from an accident that needing a system of a general picture of all populations, world populations, for this work on history and geography of human genes, I decided that the only list of populations that existed was the list of languages, which are about 6,000. And besides, we were interested only in indigenous populations, that is, populations before the great diaspora that was started with the discovery of America. And so our populations were put into the computer by language. But eventually, when this was done, I thought, well, let's compare anyhow what happens, if there is some, what similarity there is. And there was a great similarity. And so we published in 1988 a short note on Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in which we showed the comparison. We call it putting together archaeology, genetics, and linguistics. And we showed the similarity and the differences that exist, because some languages are lost, some are replaced, many are replaced. The arrival of Europeans after to the rest of the world in after Columbus spread enormously European languages. But we are interested in the indigenous languages. Well, the interest in of this work was that I later discovered, because a friend told me, you know, Darwin said in that, and I didn't remember it. I realized he didn't say it in the first edition of the Origin of Species, but he said it in the second, in chapter 14. It's just a short period, and he says, if we knew the genealogy of human evolution, we would also be able to predict that in languages. And as usual, he was right, except he was perhaps even more optimistic than it's possible, because there are languages like Basque, which survived for 30, not in such, but with enormous transformation, for 30, 40,000 years, and yet they are very different from all the surrounding ones, but they are similar with Caucasian languages, with Chinese languages, and with languages, some languages from North America called Nadene, because that was a very early spread, and very few of those languages survived as isolates, where there was enough strong isolation that the languages were kept, strong social cohesion also, so responsible for that. And others have been spread much later, of course. However, that was a very satisfactory thing. And then one of the linguists of the long range, whom I told this, made a realization of Fisher. He generated the tree of language families on the basis of, and I added to them the dates, because we know the dates of separations of from counting numbers of mutations and in many other ways, and of course comparing with archaeology, which shows very good agreement most of the times, all the times, I would say. So this is the story, more or less, because it comes really... The only thing that I did since, I made an effort to work on Y chromosome, because it proved difficult. And the genes that had been found were not good enough, except very, very few. And I thought people have not been patient enough. And I thought when Miller worked in determining mutation rates, he was patient enough to count hundreds of thousands of flies. We must look at, if necessary, at hundreds of thousands of Y chromosomes. It was not necessary, but we had to look at quite a few. This was done at Stanford with Peter Underhill and Peter Öffner in my lab. And after I did the first gene, I went to Italy and left people to work. And Peter Underhill decided that it was too slow to sequence all those things. I was good enough to invent a new machine that could do polymorphisms much faster with Peter Öffner. So the work became much faster. And the Y chromosome tree is absolutely beautiful. It's more beautiful than the mitochondrial DNA tree, although it says almost exactly the same things. Because it's difficult to get mutations, because they are rare. Mutation rate mitochondria is much higher than that of my chromosome. That generates confusions. There have been confusions in Berlin between.
Yeah.
I suppose that they have all been cleared by now, but I don't know. But why chromosome? We don't have that.
Yeah. Luca, if you were to start your career by now, what would you go for?
Well, today.
Today.
Knowing what, I would go into neurophysiology.
Ah, okay.
Because the genome has become a sort of big engineering effort.
Yeah.
I still want to do something on the new chances that are offered by the genome. I hope to do them next year. But because after all, I've set up this collection of cell lines, which is called Human Genome Diversity Project. It's been very useful to many people, and it's been used by 91 laboratories so far. And so I still want to do something, but if I were to start from scratch, I would go into neurophysiology, because that has tremendous opening. And there are many difficult problems, because it's you have a tendency to use too much the Latin census, which is post hoc ergo propter hoc, which means if something happened before, it has to be the cause of what happened later. But it's not as simple as that when you look at the neuroimaging. Anyhow, you were asking me to say something about the
experience. I spent
only 2 years at Cambridge. And the reason why I left was that I had been offered a job that the university did not maintain its promise, which was a source of great anger from Fisher. But that was not the main reason, because I was quite happy all the time with Fisher. And we had a very good rapport. And I loved Cambridge. But I was offered a very good job back to Italy, and I thought, if I don't go back now, I'll never go back. So I left, and whenever I went back to Cambridge, also recently for a honorary degree, I love it. It's such a beautiful city, and I enjoy the atmosphere, even though it's a very peculiar atmosphere, because it's an extreme British atmosphere, in a way, of privacy is very highly is greatly honored, which is good, but sometimes it makes life a little bit more difficult. And in the north of Europe, of course, in order to get people to speak really freely, you have to have them have a fair amount of alcohol. And of course, this is one way that frees people, to freeze their speech more easily.
What was your college, and what's your college?
My college, I'm an honorary fellow. I'm very, very proud of it. Is Bonneville at Caius, which was Fisher's college. So he got me first a senior member of the senior room, and I went there almost every week once for dinner, and then they offered me honorary fellowship again, I find that the atmosphere in the colleges is great. It reminds me a little bit of the very high levels of a big church like the Catholic Church. You know, I tend to think of fellows like as bishops a little bit, and not that I know many bishops, I know many more fellows, and the similarity is perhaps very remote. But every time I go to Cambridge, I enjoy it immensely. So please invite me.
Okay, look, I think we have to finish.
Yes.
So I thank you very much. And aspetta, faccio questa cosa qui.
Benissimo.
So today it was the 5th of December 2006. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great to have you here.
Grazie, Luca. Thank you very much.
Okay.